Tomorrow is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. If you haven't seen the new film Selma about the 1965 voting rights marches, I encourage you to. How many of you have seen it already? Okay, so a scattering. Very good. Among other reasons to see this film, although it doesn't name explicitly that they were Unitarian Universalists, it does feature the story of two Unitarian Universalists who were martyred in Selma. The Reverend James Reeb, he's actually called a priest. I think they thought when they first heard that he had died, he was from Boston, so they just assumed he was Catholic. You can recognize him by his iconic bow tie, but the Reverend James Reeb was associated with All Souls Unitarian here in D.C. President Johnson invoked Reverend Reeb's murder in calling for the passage of the voting rights bill. Dr. King preached Reeb's eulogy in Brown Chapel in Selma, Alabama, in March of 1965. Viola Liuza, a UU laywoman, is also mentioned in the film. She was also killed by members of the KKK in Selma and is depicted as well. I'll be saying more about Selma in a sermon on March 8th for the actual 50th anniversary of the marches. In the meantime, if you're interested in learning more, I highly recommend the powerful new book by my colleague, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, called The Selma Awakening, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. That's very much a worthwhile book to read in the next few months as we lead up to the 50th anniversary in March. One of the many reasons why the film Selma is so riveting is that it focuses much more on the behind-the-scenes dynamics of the Selma to Montgomery marches, much more than the more familiar public events. So you get to think about some of what was going on behind the scenes. And the often hidden background is what I want to focus on this morning. Among the many important and significant figures that made Dr. King's leadership possible, I would like to share with you about Rosa Parks, the rest of the story. Many historians would argue that without Rosa Parks, Dr. King may never have become the famous figure that he was. I'll be drawing from an important new biography published in 2013 by Beacon Press on the rebellious life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Parks is mostly remembered for one isolated moment in her life, a vital and important and significant act of civil disobedience, being arrested for refusing to give up her seat to a white man, for her courageous act of conscience that helped catalyze the Montgomery bus boycotts. She has been called the mother of the civil rights movement. Upon her death in 2005, she was the first woman and only the second African-American to have her body lie in state in honor in the U.S. Capitol. To quote some representative commentaries from around that time on her death, then-Senator Barack Obama described Parks as a small, quiet woman whose name will be remembered. Senator Hillary Clinton similarly recalled quiet Rosa Parks moments. The New York Times called her the accidental matriarch of the civil rights movement. Almost universally, she was remembered as quiet, humble, dignified, soft-spoken, not angry, never raising her voice. And she was remembered almost exclusively upon her death for that one moment in time, December 1st, 1955, 50 years ago this past December. This romanticized view of Rosa Parks masks the fullness of her life, which included nearly seven decades of activism. Her refusal on December 1st, 1955, to give up her seat was itself deeply shaped by the previous more than a decade of activism leading up to that point. And she continued her social justice work for four more decades after that. And although she recognized the strategic value of nonviolence, far from being meek and mild, Rosa Parks' hero, that she said multiple times in interviews, was not Dr. King, but Malcolm X. She certainly loved and admired King greatly, but Malcolm's boldness and his clarity, his affirmation of what needed to be done for black people, made him her champion. Indeed, the Parks family, like many black Southerners, had long kept a gun in their home, even as they publicly participated in nonviolent activism in public. Indeed, you can go back and look, Bayard Rustin, who was the African-American gay organizer of the March on Washington, when he first went into King's home before King had, you know, been fully converted by Gandhi to nonviolent activism, guns were everywhere in the King home. Remembering the fullness of Parks' life can remind us of the importance of committing long-term for the long haul to causes of social justice. And as important as individual acts of conscience are, like Rosa deciding all alone by herself to not give up her seat, the most important acts of conscience, and they're most effective, they typically emerge out of, and this is the case with Parks, and they're typically connected to, when they're most effective, to larger ongoing movements and communities. Along these lines, Theo Harris, who is Parks' biographer, she's a political science professor, notes that whereas many closer looks at public figures tend to demythologize them in ways that expose their all too human flaws, she writes, it is a rare gift to deconstruct the popular narrative around a historical figure, and as is the case with Parks, discover in the process a more impressive and substantive figure underneath. Rosa Louise Parks was born in 1913. Her grandparents had been enslaved. She grew up amidst the terrors of the Jim Crow South. It was World War II that catalyzed her move to activism. Her brother, so seeing black soldiers, especially like her brother, go and fight for freedom and equality in the world, and then to return home and not be treated for freedom and equality, that's what catalyzed her in December 1943, well more than a decade before December 1st, 1955, to attend her first meeting of the Montgomery branch of the NAACP. Coincidentally, it was election day. She was the only woman. She was elected secretary. If you see the film Selma, one of the many wrenching scenes involves a woman, played by Oprah Winfrey, struggling to register to vote in the face of a corrupt voting registrar and the intimidation tactics that he's using. And from 1943 to 1945, again, more than a decade before December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks was one of those women. She finally prevailed through extreme perseverance and clever strategy to register to vote, and she voted in 1945 for the governor of Alabama. She didn't vote for who won, but she voted for the governor of Alabama. And throughout the late 1940s, Parks traveled throughout Alabama. So the entire decade leading up to December 1st, 1945, she traveled throughout Alabama documenting suspicious deaths, documenting attacks on black women by white men, documenting instances of voter intimidation and other acts of racial injustice. And her goal was to gather evidence to support a federal anti-lynching bill and related legislation. It was widely known in the decade coming up to December 1st, 1955, that if a racial injustice happened to you, Rose will talk to you. That was her reputation. All of that groundwork started in 1943 and is part of what culminated in her decision not to give up her seat on December 1st, 1955. But it's also important to note that after more than a decade of painstaking, dangerous, in many ways demoralizing work to have to listen to story after story of tragedy in the 40s and early 50s, it's important to remember that her decision in December 1st, 1955 was also caught up in this large sweep of history, these systemic changes that were happening at the time. A year and a half earlier than December 1st, 1955, in May of 1954, is when the Supreme Court of the United States issued Brown versus the Board of Education, desegregating public schools, overturning the racist precedent that Parks had grown up with of 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, that said separate but equal. A year later, on May 31st, 1955, only 6 months before that day on the bus, the Supreme Court issued the follow-up ruling known as Brown 2, that integration must happen with all deliberate speed. Significantly, 2 months after that Brown 2 decision, from late July through early August of 1955, so again, barely before ending in August, leading up to that December night, Parks attended a two-week workshop at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee entitled Racial Desegregation, Implementing the Supreme Court Decision. Beyond the important content of that training, Parks had been deeply shaped by being part of that Highlander's training. That workshop was about half black and half white. And the simple act of eating together, all together in a room, half black and half white, all eating together, sleeping in the same dormitory, half black and half white, she writes that the naturalness of that integration at the Highlander School, evident but not belabored, was key in giving her a vision for how things really could be different, and that the status quo was not justified. Also, only weeks after Parks completed that Highlander training, 14-year-old Emmett Till's horrific murder in Mississippi captured the attention of the media and, in turn, the country. Parks wept when she saw the photo of Till's body in Jet magazine. Furthermore, 4 days before she would make that historic bus stand or seat, Parks attended a packed mass meeting at Dexter Avenue Church where they spoke about the recent terrible series of attacks and lynchings that had been happening in Mississippi. So 4 days before, she had been tragically reminded of what her people were facing. As Theo Harris writes, the popular view of Parks as either an accidental or angelic heroine misses the years of gathering courage and fortitude and community, which then enabled her to refuse to give up her seat. Now, there's a lot more to be said as well about the history of bus resistance in Montgomery, people who had acted and done bus resistance before Rosa. But for this morning, I'll skip ahead to that fateful evening. I didn't know previously, and Laura spoke a little bit about this morning, that Parks had previously had a humiliating confrontation with that same bus driver. It actually happened in 1943, that same year that she went to the became secretary of the NAACP. So well more than a decade before she had had that humiliating experience with that bus driver. And she had intentionally avoided his bus for 12 years straight. That evening, she was tired and she was distracted. She was looking forward to going home. It was a short 15-minute bus ride to where her husband, doing what he should have been doing, was cooking her supper. And she was enjoying the Christmas decorations out the bus window. Also related to the unplanned timing of her act of civil disobedience is that she had never before that evening been directly asked by a white person to give up her seat. So it might have happened sooner. We don't know what would have happened, but she had never before been directly asked. That evening, because the white section was full, when a white man boarded the bus driver called for the next row of sections, so the first row of the middle section, to be cleared. And so what that meant was that 4 African Americans, including Rosa, would all have to get up their seat, move to the back of the bus, and stand up so that one white man could have that full row to himself and not have to sit beside a person of color. In Parks' words, people always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired. And that's just not true. I was not tired physically, or I was no more tired physically than I was every single night of my life that I worked. No, I was tired. I was tired of giving in. It's important to note as well that city code gave powers of the police officer to bus drivers. All bus drivers were white, and all bus drivers, including the one that confronted her that evening, carried an open handgun. Theo Harris records that the bus was crowded and the tension heightened as the driver walked back to her. So he had yelled back to her to move her seat. She didn't. So he got up. He was much bigger than her physically, had a gun on his hip. Refusing to assume a deferential position, Parks looked him straight in the eye. The driver asked, "Are you going to stand up?" And she replied, "No, because I got on first. I paid the same fare, and I don't think it's right for me to have to stand so that someone could get on who got on later should be able to sit down." For her, I think it's also worth noting, it was also a matter of she saw herself as a lady. And being asked to give up her seat for a man, irrespective of color, was also deeply offensive and humiliating to her. So he said, "Well, I'm going to have you arrested." And she replied, "Well, you may do that." Given her NAACP organizing experience, that previous decade that she had spent recording these horrific acts of violence against black people, she was exceedingly cognizant of the dangers a black woman in particular faced with getting arrested. "I didn't know if I would get off the bus alive or if something, you know, also terrible could happen to her. But she says, I was resigned to the fact that I had to express my unwillingness to participate in being humiliated in this manner." Over the years, Parks particularly highlighted that there were other people she knew on that bus, but none came to her defense. She called it one of the worst days of my life. She said, "I felt very much alone," and she fantasized about what it would have happened differently if the whole bus had emptied in solidarity with her, or if the other 3 on her row had stayed, because she said, "If 4 had been arrested instead of 1, I at least wouldn't have felt so alone." Parks' civil disobedience helped launch the Montgomery bus boycotts, which contributed to the Supreme Court's unanimous decision almost a year after Parks' arrest to nullify all of the bus segregation laws in this country. Now, again, there's much more to be said about all that happened in that immediate wake of Parks' arrest, including the sexism that excluded her from the male-dominated civil rights movement. She had spoken, you know, it was certainly not the case that she couldn't speak publicly. She was a little bit shy, but she had given a speech as she was also a state secretary of the NAACP at one point and had spoken before the entire state NAACP to thunderous applause. So the fact that she wasn't asked to speak, that only men spoke, taking, you know, at her, the wake of her arrest is notable. Also, for details, I encourage you, anyone interested, to read The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. But to keep my focus and make sure I tell the rest of the story of Parks' life that is too seldom told, it's often not remembered that barely more than a month after her arrest, both Parks and her husband had been forced out of their respective jobs and were unable to get hired anywhere else. The Parks family suffered economic hardship for a full decade after her arrest. That lasted until John Conyers, Detroit's second black member elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, hired her in 1965. He was aware of her plight and said, "Come to Detroit, be my administrative assistant in my office." But even as the family's situation improved economically, she still continued to suffer negative consequences of her decision and her bravery. Even after moving to Detroit, she continued to receive hate mail and menacing phone calls well into the 1970s. I noted earlier that the tributes given upon Parks' death almost uniformly failed to note how radical she was over such a long period of time or anything close to the extent of her seven decades of activism. While she was alive, though, she did her best to subvert such misconceptions. For example, at the Kennedy Center Gala in honor of her 77th birthday, while most of the performers were apolitical, when it was her turn to speak, she didn't want to talk about just what happened in 1955. She wanted to talk about contemporary political issues. In particular, she spoke about the need to be in solidarity with Nelson Mandela's anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. After being mugged at age 81, of all the people to mug, Rosa Parks, the guy did not know he was mugging Rosa Parks, and I should add that when the word got out that Mrs. Parks had been mugged, the criminal element found the guy and beat him up, for better or worse. But she actually said publicly that evening, "I hope to someday see an end to the conditions in our country that would make people want to hurt one another and to mug one another." She also spoke out after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, against the military response to the attacks and called on the United States to act cooperatively as part of the community of nations within the framework of international law, a fairly risky stance to take, even for Rosa Parks. Theo Harris, in her conclusion, writes that doing justice to Parks' legacy and to her life requires something much harder for our nation than a simple casket lying in the Capitol. It means acknowledging the roots of the racial and social injustice in American society are deep and they continue to be manifest. We've talked about this some in books like The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. It's extremely important. If you haven't read that book, I encourage you to do so. Theo Harris continues, "It entails a profound commitment to remembering and living out and extending the goals that Rosa Parks spent her lifetime fighting for. Real justice under the law for all people. Community empowerment and protecting voting rights. Educational access and equity. Economic justice and black history in all parts of the curriculum. It calls for dedicated, persistent action year after year, decade after decade, as she did to create systemic social change for all." In her early 80s, speaking about what she wanted her legacy to be, Parks said, "I'd like people to say that I'm a person who always wanted to be free, but that I didn't just want that for myself. I wanted it for all people." May it be so for us and for all